Build.
Introduction. You made it to the second chapter. We'll now discuss how to build your idea. In the previous chapter, we looked at how to find ideas for your product. To avoid getting stuck in an infinite loop of brainstorm and bullshit, you want to start building as soon as possible. The faster you get it out, the faster you'll see if people want to use it, how they use it, and what other features they want to see you build. Without shipping, it's difficult to get any idea of what they want. There are obvious exceptions here. Apple hardly uses any focus groups or user testing. They choose to ship the very best, according to them. That's fine, but you're not Apple yet. Build fast and minimal. While a decade ago development time was long and took lots of planning to get right, today we can go from idea to basic product in a matter of days. We have cheap and easy to set up servers, virtual private servers, or VPS, like Linode and DigitalOcean, and platforms as a service, PaaS, like Heroku, that take out all the difficulty of setting up your own server. Server operating systems like Ubuntu have become relatively simple to set up with tutorials readily being available online. The web server software itself has become fast and simple too. NGINX allows us to set up a basic default server that doesn't need much further configuration. Languages like Ruby, JavaScript, PHP, and their frameworks like Ruby on Rails, Meteor, Laravel, make it easy to build products by skipping the groundwork. It's fine if you don't recognize a lot of the terms in the previous paragraph. This isn't a technical book, and the tools with which you make your product don't really matter in the beginning, and not even that much later either. My point is the speed of the development can be very fast now, and the zeitgeist of our time is transient too. Everything moves fast now, and where in the past, people would use an app for days or weeks, now you literally have seconds to make an impact, or they close, uninstall it. So you have to move fast to stay ahead. Another attribute of our zeitgeist is minimalism. Users finally accept minimal interfaces and minimal functionality, as long as an app does what it says well. There are single-purpose apps now that just do one small thing very well. Many of them have been quite successful. Downsides of fast development. There are downsides to this culture of fast development. There are products these days which are still littered with bugs when shipped. They might not work well on all mobile devices. They're not tested. There's products that are launched and work great in the first week, but then their developers stop maintaining them and they break after a few months. The remaining users get annoyed when the app stops working. With development being fast, rough, and dirty, so are the results. The other downside is you don't have the time for sophistication and details. Code has a higher potential to become an epic mess of spaghetti because there's less architectural planning involved. But then again, you can always rewrite code, right? At least you've shipped. Users don't care how your code looks. Your enemy is perfection. The reasons you should launch fast are to avoid inaction due to perfection. You should start avoiding striving for perfection now and maybe later too. This applies to all phases of doing a startup and maybe even life, but especially the start. Perfectionism is detrimental because 9 out of 10 times it doesn't make things better, but just creates inaction. You'll have 50 meetings, 100 iterations of an idea or feature just to get it right, when actually you should have just gotten it out of the door immediately and let people use it and learn from them using it. Perfectionism is necessary in smaller details of your service or startup, but not in the entire thing because then it will simply paralyze you with inaction and fear that what you do is not perfect. Nothing is perfect at the start. Things become perfect through lengthy iterations. If you're in the early stages of a company, you want to get out stuff as fast as possible. Actually, overall, I think in the entire stage, it will be useful to do that because users love new features. They love to test new stuff. They're actually pretty okay getting into bugs. They know development is difficult these days. I mean, Gmail was in beta for a decade. People are fine with errors as long as they can use something new, and as long as the errors get fixed, and if they have some way to tell you the feedback about the errors, for example. I think getting stuff out the door is the number one priority. Avoiding perfectionism is a skill you have to develop. You need to learn to be fine with everything being not fine. Not everything will be perfect and high quality. Maybe your website will have the wrong images, the wrong background colors, and the logo color doesn't match the branding text in the rest of the page. Is that important? Really? It's okay for a day. It needs to be fixed at some point, but it's not a priority. The product works. Prioritize perfectionism. Perfect what needs to be perfected now. The stuff that's low priority, don't put too much effort in it to perfect it. You'll always have time to perfect stuff later. You can always iterate and develop it to be great later. Why not perfect it step by step? Make small improvements. There's a limit to this, though. Don't make shitty products. With minimum viable products, there's been a rise of people shipping products that look bad and hardly work. A first prototype should function really well. It's fine if there's some bugs on the side, but the core functionality should be operational. It should look at least okay, otherwise you simply turn people away. Minimum needs to be minimum good. How viable should a minimum viable product MVP be? The bad MVPs we're seeing recently are creating a counter movement against the lean product development trend, and that's understandable. A lean or minimum viable product doesn't mean it can be shit. It has to actually function. Users have to be able to use it. Bugs are fine, but users should be able to report them instantly, like with a feedback chat box pop-up. You'll also have to fix bugs fast, or people will get annoyed, and you'll just grow more and more bugs. Making a minimum viable product means it has to be viable. It's not an excuse to be lazy and make something half-assed. So it's all about balance. Make something great that functions, and it can be minimal. But make sure it works. Build yourself or outsource. Many people ask me if they should build their product themselves, outsource it to other people, or hire full-time employees to build it for them. I have a pretty extreme opinion about this that goes against the grain of what most say, but I think I'm right because times are changing. DIY versus people who hire others to do it for them. I think you can get quite far by letting other people develop your product for you, but the problem is that in the long term, you won't be able to have the same speed as a product maker with development skills. To give you an example, my day usually starts with waking up, showering, having some coffee, seeing what bug on one of my sites is emailed, tweeted, shared with me today. Someone sends me a bug report almost every day, and I'll see if I can fix it immediately. Then I'll see other stuff on my site that I don't like, and I'll just change it on the fly. All of this usually takes a few minutes. Those are just small tweaks every day, but over a year that's like 300 to 1,000 small tweaks, which add up. Now imagine if you outsource all of this, and you have to ask 1,000 times for a developer to tweak this and that. For me, a small tweak or bug fix will take just a few minutes, because I can do it myself. But for you, each tweak takes a message to your developer, who then has to be working that day, and awake, to get it fixed. He might have to do a meeting about it with his team, so it might take a few hours, or days, or weeks. Now imagine if we have the same site, and you and me are competing. In the time you've sent a bunch of emails to your developers, I've already pushed 5 bug fixes and added 2 new features to my app. Who's going to win here? Who's faster? Not you. Now think about your users. They're now stuck with a bug for 3 days because your developer is hiking up a mountain in Peru for holiday. I fixed that bug while having my coffee in the morning in 5 minutes. What will your users like more, your broken app or my working one? It's not all roses, though. Doing everything yourself in the long term probably doesn't work. If you've proven a business model, it's probably smart to keep repeating it by scaling it up, getting people to work for you, with you managing the operations instead of micromanaging and fixing tiny bugs. But that's not what this book is about. We're talking about the beginning. In that case, DIY always tops outsourcing for me. DIY versus big teams with VC money. I've seen countless real-life examples of VC-funded companies spending loads on building giant development and design teams, or paying the same money to outsource development and design agencies. There's lots of exceptions where it went right, but mostly in the beginning, this just slows you down terribly. There's been about 5 big direct nomad list competitors come and go, now that have been VC-funded, from $1 to $10 million in funding, with teams from 10 to 30 people that made the same site as me. But they all didn't go anywhere. While working alone in my underwear on the side of my hotel bed with my MacBook and my coffee, I was able to outcompete million-dollar VC-funded teams of 30-plus people, in an office in San Francisco, with air on chairs, oakwood meeting desks, $20,000 espresso machines, bean bags, and ping pong tables. That's a really cool thing about the time we live in. It's a pretty fair race. You just need to make a better product than other people, and it gets rewarded by people using it. When starting up, you don't need a team if you have the skills yourself. You don't need startup capital if you have the skills yourself. And getting the skills yourself isn't that hard if you can search every question on Google. And in my opinion, having those skills sets you apart. You don't even need to be great at it. I'm not great at programming or design. I'm pretty average. But because I can do it all well enough, I have an advantage over many people, teams, and companies who are specialized. My gripe with venture capital in terms of building products. My social media outrage might make you think differently, but I don't hate venture capital. It has its function and place, but I don't like to see other people's money wasted on bullshit. And there's plenty of VC money funding bullshit. The costs of building a startup, especially in the beginning, are almost $0 now. That is, if you use your own current skills. There's a problem with the current narrative for how you're supposed to build a startup. Get VC money from day one. Hire too many developers, designers, rent an expensive office, have your team build something, buy an espresso machine, do team building retreats, buy startup goodies like t-shirts and hats with your logo, get drunk in a jacuzzi to celebrate raising more money. Oops, the product didn't get traction. Sorry, VC, we shut it down. Buy money. The more sustainable way to build a startup, build something yourself, see if it works. No. Build something else. See if it works. No, build another thing. See if it works. It works? Let's see if I can monetize it. I can hire some people now with the money I'm making with it. Now I have a team of a few people. If we want, we can rent an office or just save money and stay remote. The business model seems to be proven because every time I spend $1 more, I get $150 in revenue. Thus, it's scalable. This means if I get more money, I can spend more and get more profit theoretically. Maybe we can borrow or get some angel investor or VC to fund our expansion in return for giving away some of our ownership or use our cash flow for it. We got more money now. We spend it on the right things. And now we're making even more profit. It worked. Now the product is really cool. People love it. And we're making lots of money. Mission accomplished. Let's see if I can sell the product because I want to do other stuff with my life. Build a family, start a farm, raise kids. Okay, I sold it for $500,000 to $10,000. Now I have financial independence in return for a few years of hard work, and my investors are happy too. This is relevant because venture capital money can destroy the build process before it's even begun. If approached wrong, raising money means you can skip the actual product validation if people want the product, and finding a business model. Because you don't need money to survive, you have funding. It lets people spend lots of money without having to see any positive results for it for a long time. That causes people and companies to be jaded. It's not natural for humans. The natural tension of having to survive is healthy, and it makes people act in superhuman ways. There's always the story of the son or daughter of rich parents who could never find a job until their parents cut all spending on them. And suddenly they found a job because they had to get a job to survive. I think the same applies to companies. If you don't need to find a business model to survive, you're not really going to prioritize looking for it either. Bootstrapping versus venture capital. Bootstrapping has become an advantage. You keep your costs low, naturally. You get zero of the bullshit attached with VC money. You maintain full ownership over your product and its roadmap. Where you want to go with it. You maintain full ownership over the equity so that when you sell it later, you'll get lots of money instead of just a diluted 5% because VCs took the rest. And in our times, you don't really need a lot of money to build something yourself. A simple web server is $5 a month. A code editor like VS Code is free. To make iOS apps, Xcode is free. An Apple developer license is $100 a year. Not a lot compared to the money you can make back from it if you can get people to use your product and pay you hard dollars for it. Bootstrapping has become a very viable option for most software-based startup ideas, whereas Venture capital has become tedious to get, schedule 6 months of meetings, limits your freedom, grow crazy big or die, and not really necessary at all. Did I mention how much less stressful bootstrapping is yet? No, well, it is. The importance of keeping costs down. In the early stages of any project that's not funded, keeping your costs down is your biggest priority. And if you use your own skills to make the basics, that's a lot of costs saved. Developers these days are crazy expensive due to high demand for them. Most devs go for $50 to $250 hour. Just the MVP of any small app will already cost roughly 100 hours of work. So there you go. That's $5,000 to $25,000. A fully functioning app will cost thousands of hours, from $50,000 and up. That's a lot of money if you don't have a lot of money. So, if you have access to a big money pile, then why not? Go and hire some people to build it. But you'll still be competing with a lot of DIYers that don't have that cost, and you'll want to get your cost back at some point in the form of revenue. If your development costs are so much higher than the rest, you'll also need to make a lot more money than the rest. Possible, but hard, especially in the beginning. Now, the worst you can do is contact a developer and ask them to work for free in return for a 50% share of profit, while you get the other 50% because you came up with the idea. It's become a startup trope, and it's ridiculous. The market value of an idea without execution is $0. So either you get real skills, an MBA, such skills, or get money to pay developers. Paying with future equity is ridiculous. It's like paying with a $5 lottery ticket. Don't make a joke out of yourself. Nobody works for free anymore. You have to understand, as a developer, you can now make $150,000 a year as a starting salary in San Francisco. Do you really think anyone cares about your startup idea of a random person such as yourself? Not unless you have something to bring to the table, like money or skills. Some people used to add connections to that list, but I don't really believe networking is important in this age anymore. What's important is the product, and to make it, you need money or skills. To build, should you learn to code? Yes, I'd recommend you learn it. It's only getting easier now. Learning to code seems steep for newbies, but people approach it wrong. You can probably ride a bicycle, right? When you started learning to ride a bicycle, did you think you'd be Lance Armstrong? No. And you probably aren't. You can just ride it, but you're not competing in world championships. It's the same with learning to code. It doesn't mean you have to be great or even good at it. Just know some bits so you can throw stuff together. When I code, every day I have to Google how to do stuff. I don't know. Coding is continuous learning. You can ask any programmer and they'll answer the same. The good thing is there's so much information on the internet nowadays. Almost every problem you face, someone else probably had before you. If you're looking for ways to learn to code, I'd say don't go for courses, boot camps, or mentors. They usually cost a lot of money, and they don't teach you the core of coding, figuring it out yourself. That's the biggest skill, fiddling for hours to days to get something working, not giving up and keep trying. And then suddenly, eureka. If you want to learn to code, my advice is try to build your idea with HTML and CSS and some JavaScript and see how far you get. Just Google every single thing you don't know. Start with how to make a HTML page. Then, how to make text colored in HTML. Then, how to make a button in HTML, etc. Keep searching. You'd be surprised how far you get. This is how I and many others have learned to code. Figure it out for yourself. If you really don't want to learn to code, read on as I'll discuss how to build a basic app without a single line of code later in this chapter. Tools. Which tools should you use to build? I'm a strong believer that right now you should use whatever tool works best for you. What tool do you already know? You've already worked with Ruby once? Was it fun? Use that. You've already worked with PHP? Then use that. What you should definitely not do is listen to programming hipsters on the internet telling you which language is best. Here's a little secret. The people discussing what programming language is best are not shipping products. The people who don't care what programming language they're using are shipping products. They'll use whatever tool they need, whenever they need it. So use whatever is easiest for you to learn or work with, and then switch whenever you feel you've outgrown a language. But honestly, unless you're programming spaceships, it's pretty hard to outgrow a language. They're all based on the same principles of computing. You can build anything with most languages, really. Facebook was built on PHP, Twitter on Ruby, Google on Java, Reddit on Python, Hacker News on Arc. The thing is, you're not building for the enterprise here. You're building a first product that might grow into something bigger and then turn into a startup company. You can always switch. Twitter switched from Ruby to Java after they kept going down. Twitter still exists. When Facebook became popular, it became overloaded with users, so they wrote their own engine, called HipHop, to speed up PHP. And they started writing critical parts that needed more speed in other languages. The point is, it didn't stop them from being successful, so surely it won't matter for you. What if you don't code? I'd recommend you to learn to code, of course. But for you, I've written an entire part on how to build without code, further down in this chapter. My light stack. What I use personally grew out of my limitations. I wasn't educated in computer science or even programming, and I simply used what I knew a little bit about. I didn't listen to everyone telling me what hip new framework, anything JS, etc., or language, Ruby, etc., to program. I knew some PHP from making some WordPress sites before, and years before that, I making my websites interactive with Perl, and it looked pretty similar. Now the point is, don't go learn PHP, but use what you already know and see how far you get with it, and move to the next language or framework if you're starting to reach its limitations, which seems very hard with most modern languages. The basic light stack is a front-end client that is built with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. You then use the JavaScript to communicate with the server by making a web request. That request is received by your backend server. This backend can run anything. I use PHP, but nowadays you can also run JavaScript on the server with Express or Node.js, for example. You separate the backend server from the front-end client for security reasons, because you don't want to let your entire user database be viewable by one user, right? The backend code connects to your database. SQLite, MySQL, or PostgreSQL are great. SQLite specifically is great because it doesn't require you to install a lot. And when you make a database, it's just a file. It's very transportable. You can literally copy the database file from and to your server. There's misconceptions about SQLite that it'd be slow or not scalable enough. That's bullshit. In many cases, SQLite is now faster than the file system. So, itself. There's a giant trend now to merge the client and server-side programming with frameworks like Meteor, React, Vue, etc. And I support it. But at the time of writing this book, it simply is too convoluted and complicated for beginner programmers. It's a rabbit hole, really. We don't know where it'll go, really. Will we get more people using basic light stacks like this one, which still separate front-end and back-end? Or will people all move to frameworks like React.js? Just because a technology is newer doesn't mean it's better, though. My guess is we will probably merge front and back-end at some point. But at time of writing this book, things are changing too fast to use it for me. A good tip to choose a technology is its age. If a technology has been around for a decade or more, it's probably working well for people. PHP is over 2 decades old, and JavaScript similar. Does it matter what stack you use? Again, not really. Just use whatever works for you. In my case, that's this light stack. I keep it simple. Most companies will eventually build their own framework over time, and in a way, that's what I did. But it was never my plan. You just streamline functionality that you keep repeating. Remember, you can always switch the stack later. It'll hurt, but it's completely possible. Why are people so obsessed with tools? There's a recent trend of people becoming viciously obsessed with discussing tooling. What language do you, should you, and will you use? Why all these tool discussions when it's not that important for shipping a product? I think people are obsessed with tools because it feels like they're actually doing something productive. Because when they figure out what tools they should use, they'll go learn that tool or language and build their product right. That's the idea. But it's stupid because it never happens. They get stuck in this endless research. They'll learn a new language, then switch to the other one. Because this new language, tool, or framework may be a better fit for the product. That is the product they still have to build and ship. Not any of these people ever finished what they wanted to make. And the problem is, Every week, a new framework shows up that promises to make your app or its development even faster and easier. All of this stuff simply takes away from your goal, which is shipping a product and selling it to users and getting revenue from it. Who has this problem more than anybody? Software engineers? It helps to be a bit business eye here, because business people always care most about revenue. And if a profitable company is your goal, you should too make that your first priority, not the tools. What about the people that finished and shipped? They mostly never cared in the first place about tools. They weren't discussing which tool to use. They just made something with whatever tool seemed good enough. And they switched it whenever their tool limited them and they needed something else. Their tool set ambiguous. So stop asking that question, what do you use to make that? Or how did you make that? It's an inherently stupid question. The question should be, why did you make that? The philosophy behind something is way more important than how they made it. You can copy their tools, but you'll never be able to copy their why, which is what makes people and their products great. How do you evaluate if a new tool is useful for you? There has never been a time during which there has been as much innovation in programming languages as now, except in the post-war 20th century, with the rise of computing itself. The center of programming is on the web now. There's new languages popping up every month and new frameworks every week. This makes it hard, especially for newbies, to judge what language or framework to invest time in to learn. You learn a new language, but it might already be passé by the time you finally understand it. My approach is that I only learn what I directly need now. Let's say I'm building a new app where I need to make beautiful charts in HTML quickly. I'll try it on my own first, but if it's too much work, I'll just Google charts in JavaScript. I'll find D3.js, the dominant visualization framework for JavaScript, and learn some basic stuff to build a chart. The thing is, I only learn what I need when I need it. Instead of spending months on learning an entire language, framework, or tool, I just learn the bit that I need now. This is a much faster and leaner approach, which will save you time and make you more productive. And actually ship your product. I don't have so much of an inherent interest in programming that I'll go and learn stuff just for fun. I know many people do. If your goal is to ship, that might be a disadvantage, because you'll learn lots of stuff you don't necessarily need, and you'll be playing around with tools more than you'll be finishing your product. Native versus web. Web. A web app is a website that has the functionality that makes it an application. It can look the same as a native app, except that you access it through a web browser like Safari or Chrome on your phone. You'll probably build it with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript. Native. A native app means that you program it in the language native to the device you use, and it'll be an actual app installed on the device. For an iPhone, that means you'll build it for iOS and it'll use Objective-C or the new simpler language Swift. That's usually what people mean when they say mobile apps. User experience and development. In general, a native app's user experience feels faster than a web app. Although with modern web apps, you can get pretty close. It depends how good you are at coding and optimizing it. In general, development of web apps is faster, but the user experience is slower, whereas development of mobile apps is slower, but the user experience is faster. A native app has the disadvantage that users have to actually install your app. That takes another user action, whereas with a web app, all you have to do is click on a link from another website, like Facebook, Twitter, or even the New York Times, and it'll open up. A web app is nothing more than just a sophisticated website that is made to look like an application. Updating native apps versus web apps. When you make a change to a native app, you need to deploy it to Apple and Android's app stores. It needs to be reviewed by their staff, and it might take days before your update is pushed into the store, and weeks until all users download and update it. Instead, updating a web app literally means uploading the new version to your server, and every user that loads it will immediately load the new version. That means instant updates. Hybrid web plus native apps. There's famous hybrid apps that are half native and half website. Until recently, Uber used to be a hybrid. This meant it could launch special features on the map, like for Valentine's Day, cars in the shape of hearts, as this was just some HTML they changed, without having to deploy an update to the app stores. A more recent example of somewhat hybrid apps is React Native, which probably is outdated by the time of reading this, which is a framework that lets you write platform-independent code for both iOS and Android in a HTML, CSS, and JS-like style to make native apps. What are people using most? There's some data that suggests people on mobile devices spend more time using native apps than web. That's probably true. But they'll spend it in major apps like Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, WhatsApp, and Messenger, removed from this list depending on whatever is popular in the time of reading this book. These are core apps, though. They're giant. You probably won't be able, or want, to compete with these apps. How about using them as your platform? A future where your web app lives inside other native apps. What I mean sounds crazy, but it's where I see this going. People will use your web app inside these apps. What happens if you send a link to somebody on WhatsApp? They see a URL, they tap it, it opens inside WhatsApp's web browser. It's a fully functional browser, and your web app can run inside it. A web container inside some big company's native app is the real future platform for your web apps, I think. Designed for that use case. It's intrinsically viral as people will send your website's URL around and open it from there. They won't have to install anything. The web and native will merge in the future. I believe that web apps and mobile apps are converging. You see, web apps get more and more powerful and getting access to more functionality of the device that was usually limited to mobile apps. For example, the iPhone's gyroscope is now accessible through web. Other examples are how recently, 2016, iPhone's browser doesn't show entire URLs anymore, like https.nomadlist.com, Amsterdam, Netherlands, but instead shows the name of the site in the URL bar nomadlist.com. That's obviously pointing towards seeing the web more as apps. In the long term, there are a few obstacles to overcome for the two to converge. Honestly, though, it's impossible to predict. 5 years ago, I would have thought by now everything would be, but we still have users both on the web and inside native apps. Learn both. If you have spare time, learn to do both web and native app development. It's a remarkable and sought-after skill to be able to build both web apps and native apps, and of course, hybrid ones. What are you able to build now? This book is about getting something out as soon as possible. Therefore, you should choose the platform where you already have some skills. This way you can get something out as fast as possible. For most people, and definitely for me, that'll always be web. Programming and shipping native apps to mobile devices and getting them into app stores is more work than just building a website, uploading it to a server, and hooking it up to a domain name. Do what's fastest for you. Other people will say, "I'm wrong there," and you should base it on how users will use your app. That's a good point. But I don't want to see you get stuck learning Objective-C and Swift to get an iPhone app out, or paying a mobile developer $25,000 to build it for you. Remember, you can always go native later. If people use your site already, you can bug them to install your native app later. This is annoying, but it's possible. No platform choice has to be permanent. Building with constraints. I'll now discuss how to build stuff if you're constrained. Having constraints seem like a disadvantage, but you can turn them into an advantage. So many people look at the negatives in their current position, but in fact, most of these can be considered a positive advantage. No money investment. As mentioned previously, bootstrapping has become an advantage. You keep your costs low naturally. You get zero of the bullshit attached with VC money. You maintain full ownership over your product and its roadmap, where you want to go with it. You maintain full ownership over the equity so that when you sell it later, you'll get lots of money instead of just a diluted 5% because VCs took the rest. Bootstrapping has become a very viable option for most software-based startup ideas. No office. I obviously had to put this in here as I'm a big supporter of remote work. Not having to spend money on office rent is now an advantage. If you, and the people you work with, can work from anywhere, it also means you now have access to a worldwide pool of talent. Starting fully remote is much easier than switching to remote after you already have an entire set of office buildings and workers. No coding skills. Not being able to code means you can use off-the-shelf tools to quickly prototype stuff without losing yourself in giant code bases. As you'll see later in this chapter, you can build an entire landing page, get data from users, process that data, charge money without writing code. This means that you can spin up lots of different MVPs and see which one sticks without much effort. Although you're more limited in what you can make, you'll be shipping faster than people coding stuff for months. Once one takes off, you can always learn to code on the fly or get someone to help you build stuff out. No connections. You're not a famous startup person with lots of connections in the scene. Well, guess what? Those connections are mostly bullshit anyway. And if you're outside the scene and not famous, it means you can act like an underdog. You'll be more indie than most. And guess what? People love to support independent underdogs. You're fighting against big companies, and people want to see you win. That is, until you become a big company yourself, the cycle of life. The connections people have after they get successful also put them in a monoculture bubble, which you're not in yet. You think more freely, and that's better for creativity. Building a startup without coding. What if you really don't want to learn to code? That's what this part is about. You can still do it. I'll show how you can build a basic prototype with off-the-shelf tools. You'll be able to make a landing page, let users enter data, manipulate and process it, charge them money, message them, and add a task for your contractor or you to execute, and without writing a single line of code. I'll discuss tools to use for each section and give some examples. These tools are obviously subject to change and might be out of date. If they are, the general concept remains. I'll give you some guidance. It's up to you to connect everything and execute. Be creative. Building a landing page. To get your users in, you need a landing page. Luckily, these days, they're easy to build with existing website builders that give you templates to customize. One of the most famous is Squarespace. A more recent indie website maker is Card. Others are Tilda and Wix. If you need a bit more freedom and the ability to add custom code later, try WordPress. It allows you to write PHP or JS to customize your website and add features later on easily. You'll want to use your landing page to explain your product or service, and from there, lead them towards a so-called call to action, or CTA. What do you want from your users? Do you want to save their name and email? Do you want them to pay you money? Adding a big colored button in the center top of the page as a call to action will lead them click there. When they click, link them to the next part, which in most cases means collecting data from your user. Accepting user data entry. To get people to enter data and then save it, you can use Typeform or Google Forms. Typeform has better forms, but Google Forms lets you directly put the data in a Google spreadsheet, which is great. Google Forms is a bit less intuitive and more formal. Processing and manipulating user data. After you have the user's data, you probably want to do something with it, like save it or process it and then save it, or process it and do something else with it as a next step. Here's where Zapier comes in. It's magic. Zapier is a web app that lets you connect most web apps you know with others. It's like the glue in between. It can simply transfer data or parts of data it gets, like from a Google Sheet, a received email, or a Stripe transaction, and send it to another service. Or it can process and change the data in between. It even supports basic JavaScript code. You can make your own flows to do whatever you want them to do, and they'll keep running perpetually. This is a lot like scheduled cron jobs you have on the server, but again without coding yourself. There's lots of pre-made flows, so-called zaps, like taking data from or sending it to a Google form, or taking the data from Typeform and sending it to Dropbox, contacting users. After you have processed the data, you might want to contact your users. Luckily, Zapier supports MailChimp, which means you can now automatically send emails, or you can just give a nod to MailChimp to do something. In turn, MailChimp has advanced built-in automation too. That means anything you'd want to do after a user lands on your site and enters data is possible. Like send them an email 14 days after with a link to another web app, or send them an automated PayPal invoice within an hour of signing up. It doesn't stop with email. You can send an SMS message or robot voice phone call to your user with the telephone API service Twilio. Then you can even save what they respond on the phone. and in turn, send that to another web app, making tasks for contractors. What if you need a human to process some data or work with a user? Send it to productivity software Trello, where you add it as a to-do list item for your contractor to execute. Charging users payments. One of the most important parts is actually getting users to give you money. Until recently, this was reserved to people who could code payment logic together. Not anymore. Website Builder Card supports Stripe checkout, which means you simply connect your Stripe account and you can accept payments on your landing page. Okay, let's try build something. To prove to you this works, I want to build an MVP for a startup that picks up luggage anywhere in the world, where you are, and ships it to your destination. This way, you don't have to go to the airport carrying all your bags around. We won't write any code. Let's start making a landing in Card's editor. Here's how the final version looks. Then when we make a new type form asking the user for their address, pick up date, and we embed this type form into Card. The good thing about Typeform is it also supports Stripe. So we can also charge the user's credit card from within the form. Now let's go into Zapier and make sure that after payment happens, we do a few things. This Zapier Zap only runs if a new paid entry hits the type form. We automatically send an email to the customer using Gmail with information about the pickup. We automatically add the pickup order to our Google Sheet with active pickups. We automatically add a task into Trello for our pickup contractor to get the luggage. We also automatically SMS our contractor and alert with Twilio that there's a new pickup ready to be fulfilled, with the date and address. See how easy that was? We now have a fully functioning minimum viable product and actually a basic startup built. And it took about 30 minutes. You can go a lot more complicated from here. The possibilities are endless. And when you have validated your non-code MVP, you can start adding your own coded parts too to increase the complexity of your product. You can replace the off-the-shelf web apps with your own coded scripts. Let's talk APIs. The entire previous section where we connected all these web apps without code is only possible because of the existence of so-called APIs. They're application program interface, which simply means apps that can communicate to each other in slightly human-readable data. Zapier's entire app is built around connecting different APIs together. You don't need to use Zapier to use APIs, though. If you can code, you can query APIs too and save their data, and in turn send it to other APIs. One of the easiest ways to quickly build a prototype, if you can code, is to use these third-party APIs. They can provide you with data, like cost of living or weather data, platforms to build on, like Facebook and Twitter, and services, like sending emails easily. Why are they useful? APIs are ways that computers and servers can share data in a computer-readable format. It means that when I open HTTPS, nomadlist.com, Amsterdam, Netherlands, a computer will literally read this. Nomad list, the best cities to live and work remotely, etc. It goes on for pages. This stuff is nice to look at when the computer visualizes it and interprets the HTML code. But it's hard for the computer to get specific data from it, because the layout is kind of made for humans. But now if I open the same page through an API at https://nomadlist.com/api-v2-amsterdam-netherlands. This URL will probably not work anymore when you read this book, but you get the point. You and I, and even a computer, will be able to read this. Name, Amsterdam, country, the Netherlands, cost of living, $2,500 a mise, safety score, 3891, nomad score, prone 183, fund score, 3394, cost score, 2238. Now you can get the city name Amsterdam, the country the Netherlands, and how fun it is there, 3.394 out of 5 stars, and display it on your own site. That's useful. But even more useful is if you combine multiple APIs together. What if I want to find the most fun places from Nomad List and get the live weather data from somewhere else? To see where it's fun and not raining? Well, just a quick Google for weather API reveals there's a free weather API called openweathermap.org, which can give you the current weather and forecast in a computer-readable format, just like above. Let's try it. http://api.openweathermap.org/data2 5 weather, Amsterdam, name, Amsterdam, court, lawn, 53s, lat, 4, weather, main, sunny, description, clear sky and sunny, main, temp Celsius, 25.5, humidity, 49, pressure, temp on 13, temp min, 20.04, temp max, 26.04, rain, 3 hook, clouds, all, 5 more, yay, it's not raining in Amsterdam, and it's actually 25 degrees Celsius. That means we can go outside and have some drinks. Now we can combine that weather API data with the data from the Nomad List API and show it on our site. But we can go much, much further. With API services like Twilio.com, we can make an entire telephone voice and SMS service by just making calls to their API. I'll spare you the technical details as it's quite some work, but it's not difficult. It's simple, and anyone can set it up. Now start thinking of ideas. You can have a phone number you call that'll ask you some questions over voice, and even have the person answer them. Yes, Twilio has speech-to-text and text-to-speech. You can call that number to ask, what's the city you should go now, with the best weather and most fun? The more APIs you start combining, the more fun it becomes. And because the heavy load is lifted by the APIs already, you are pretty much just connecting them together into new functionality, which can be your product. You can build a business on other people's APIs. You can build entire businesses based on other companies' APIs. Many have done so before you. There's one big thing to remember, though. If you become solely dependent on one company's API, you're in a bad place. Without even telling or asking you, they can shut down their API at any time, and that will immediately destroy your business. More commonly, companies change how their APIs function whenever they want. That means you have to constantly monitor their API and see if it functions correctly. Whenever they change something, even something as small as changing the key of Nomad Cost to Nomad Cost, it will break your app and you have to change your code. Conclusion. When building, try to build fast and minimal. Instead of learning new stuff, use the tools you already know to build your idea. Make sure your MVP actually works and is not just a landing page that doesn't do anything. Lose your perfectionism, it'll never be perfect anyway. Don't outsource, build it yourself. If you can't code, use off-the-shelf tools and connect APIs together to build it. Appreciate your constraints and limitations. They can be a giant advantage versus people with lots of resources. Keep your costs low while building and later on. Build for the web first. You can go native mobile later. Don't build on an MVP too long. A good rule of thumb is to spend max 1 month on it and launch. Resources mentioned. Linode, DigitalOcean, Heroku, Ubuntu, NGINX, OLARC, Twilio, Zapier, WordPress.com. Your homework. Rank the list of ideas you made previously by which you think are best. Now see which of those best ideas you can execute quickest with the tools and skill set you already have right now. That means without learning anything else now. Build the first prototype of your idea. It's minimal, but that doesn't mean not functional. It should do something, either it being a typeform connected to Zapier or a WordPress landing page or your self-programmed web app or native app. It should have the core functionality working well to be useful for users.